Turkey. This panel is motivated by the fact that sections of the American left have called for a new deal ever since the 70s, ever since the crisis and undoing of the New Deal coalition itself. On the other hand, now, a new generation of leftists now asks whether and how this apparent demand has helped to advance the struggle for socialism during the neoliberal era and into the present, with sections of the American left now supporting calls for a Green New Deal. We're using this panel discussion to focus attention on the original New Deal and on the problems and tasks it posed for the American left during the 30s and 40s. The New Deal is widely associated with socialism. This association holds true not only within the popular imagination shared across many sections of American society, but also within the historical imagination of the contemporary left. This panel will consider the New Deal as it appeared to organize political tendencies that struggled with socialism during and after the 1930s. It will ask whether and how the New Deal, its life, its legacy, its crisis, its memory, and its potential revival has advanced the struggle for socialism in America and beyond. We've asked our panelists to address these two broad questions. The first is to clarify the relationship between the left tendencies at the time to the New Deal, and the second is how and whether this history might have been different. So the first is, how did socialists of various tendencies, the Communist Party of USA, the Socialist Party of America, the Trotskyists, and the anarchists, relate to the New Deal during the 1930s? How, in these tendencies' respective views, did the New Deal, considered both as a policy and as politics, present obstacles to and or opportunities for advancing a struggle for socialism that did not exist previously? And the second question, the liberal political coalition forged in part through New Deal policies subsequently prosecuted the first, the anti-fascist Second World War, and then the anti-communist Cold War. It also administered the American-led reconstitution of global capitalism beginning in 1945, and it did so via political phenomena such as the European welfare state that were supported by large sections of the left. Could left support for this politics have resulted in something other than the renewal of global capitalism? And if so, how? To answer these questions today, we've invited four speakers from very different political backgrounds. This might well be one of the most diverse panels of this year's Left Forum. In order of presentation, we have Jason Wright, Mark Kagan, Jack Ross, and Jack Devine. Jason Wright is a longtime supporter of the Bolshevik tendency. Mark Kagan was a transit worker, then a high school social studies teacher, and is currently a history PhD candidate at CUNY Graduate Center. His dissertation will be on the TWU Local 100 from 1975 to 2009. Jack Ross is an independent historian in Brooklyn. He is the author of The Socialist Party of America, A Complete History, also Rabbi Outcast, Elmer Berger, and American Jewish Anti-Zionism, and the forthcoming The Strange Death of American Exceptionalism. And Jack Devine is a student at the CUNY Graduate Center, as well as a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. He is a host and producer of Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI, the official radio show of the New York City chapter. He caucuses with DSA Emerge, a local movement organization committed to building a red New York. Please welcome our panelists. Okay, so we ask each of our panelists to give an opening presentation of no more than 12 minutes in duration. After this round of opening remarks, each of you is invited to take at most 4 minutes to respond to the remarks of your fellow panelists. After that, we'll open up Q&A to the floor for the remainder of the session, and we will finish at 2:30 p.m.
I think the topic today, the New Deal in American Socialism, is intriguing, as has been pointed out, the public in general, including significant portions of the American left, have seemingly experienced a Mandela effect when it comes to the memory of the Great Depression and of the New Deal. And if anyone's not familiar with the term Mandela effect in pop psychology, it's a term for collective false memories. In this case, I would argue that the predominant narrative of the New Deal is a false history promoted by liberals and latter-day liberals such as the FDR-supporting Popular Front-era Stalinists that presented New Deal-era programs as a full-fledged Keynesian stimulus program that somehow ended the Great Depression. Thus, while many of the anarchists who participated in launching the Occupy movement that swept America from coast to coast in 2011 were no doubt inspired by a more radical vision, a considerable portion of those who took part in the encampments were inspired by their visions of Great Depression-era protests, and an equally impressionistic view that the New Deal was the cure that led to an economic recovery of the U.S. This zeitgeist was captured in the title of an October 18, 2011 article in Mother Jones, Occupy Protesters One Demand, A New Deal, Well Maybe. The Democratic Party, in its role as graveyard of social struggles, certainly did its best to transform Occupy into a safety valve and to corral dissidents back into the safety of electoral channels. The association of the Democratic Party with the legacy of FDR, no matter how far the modern-day Democrats have drifted from their 1930s-era coalition and politics, gave them ample room to maneuver and reap potential benefits of the polls while making few concrete gestures to those affected by the economic crisis. The trade union bureaucrats and liberal intellectuals played a role in this as well by coupling public defense of Occupy with friendly advice to elect Democrats. Notably, Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman was a preeminent example of this. After spending much of 2008 and 2009 publicly begging the Obama administration to launch neo-Keynesian stimulus programs to no avail, he spent much of 2011 defending Occupy protesters while encouraging them to direct their energy toward practical aims, i.e. electing Democrats, in order to win neo-Keynesian stimulus programs. The rhetoric of this imagined New Deal has been seen most recently in the opaque policy proposals of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the current bien noir for both the conservatives and establishment Democrats, and an upcoming poster girl and rock star for radical liberals, thanks to the fairy tale quality of her overnight transformation from bartender to being the first self-proclaimed socialist congresswoman in US history. Paul Krugman embraced Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal as arguably an exercise in pragmatism, pointing out that the key to the Green New Deal is in ditching ineffective carbon taxes so as to avoid opposition from those who would be hurt by carbon taxes, predominantly including, though not limited to, big businesses in the fuel sector. Krugman points out that Ocasio-Cortez's proposal is something of an old-fashioned legislative Christmas tree. The traditional term for legislation festooned with lots of riders unrelated to the ostensible purpose in order to win political support. The Green New Deal is thus firmly in the tradition of the actual New Deal, though those who embrace the policy at AOC overwhelmingly do so under the mistaken impression that the New Deal was something other than it actually was. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was inaugurated as president in March 1933, and from day one of his administration, the aim of Roosevelt and the Democratic Party was to make the working class pay for the measures needed to stimulate an upturn. Spending from New Deal programs flowed overwhelmingly to industrialists, bankers, and landlords. While policies commonly associated with the New Deal, such as unemployment benefits, Social Security, and government-sponsored public relief, were concessions won by workers and activists, often through bloody battles in the streets. It's true that FDR employed considerably more populist rhetoric than his recent predecessors in the Oval Office. The well-known political aphorism that only Nixon could go to China might be easily replaced with only Franklin Delano Roosevelt could sell the New Deal to America's ruling class. FDR's patrician pedigree was key to selling the other 59 families on a bundle of mostly painless small reforms and concessions serving as a palliative and placebo to prevent American workers from seeking a more radical cure. In August 1934, writing an unpublished draft article for Liberty Magazine, the exiled Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky aptly characterized the aims and motivations of the administration's New Deal politics as, quote, aimed at overcoming difficulties. It's supposed to strengthen the foundations of the capitalist system, not destroy them. Even the most leftist of the professors in your brain trust aren't revolutionaries. They're only frightened conservatives. This was a theme Trotsky would repeatedly return to in the last 6 years of his life, including an interview with journalist William R. Matthews, later published in a December edition of the Tucson Daily Star, where Trotsky observed that the New Deal is not revolutionary. It is a program of mere palliative, seeking to cure a badly diseased body. It will, of course, fail because it does nothing to cure the causes of the disease. It represents the culmination of the final contradictions in the decay and fall of capitalism. As Chris Knox, once a leading member of the then revolutionary Spartacist League, explained it to a later generation of radicals in the pages of Workers' Vanguard, the Rooseveltian New Deal economic program under the National Industrial Recovery Act, the NRA, was designed to improve businesses by encouraging rationalization, promoting government-backed trustification, and raise public confidence in the system through massive propaganda campaigns. However, the strike wave beginning in early 1933 included a high proportion of unorganized industrial workers, which caused Roosevelt to cave into pressure from the AFL to include a right to organize clause. Actually representing no change in the realm of legal rights, the vague clause had the effect of both promoting company unions and building the authority of the AFL unions. In either case, it was designed to provide the bosses with an agency to contain the upsurge. Knox here refers to the strike wave that erupted in 1933 after a slight economic uptick following the years of starvation and austerity that had followed the 1929 stock market crash. In 1933, 15 strikers were killed, 200 were injured, and hundreds more were arrested. The 1933 strike wave ended in a series of defeats. But the state repression and government backing for the bosses showed what Roosevelt really stood for and signaled a new wave of resistance. James Buchanan, the leading contemporary figure among American Trotskyists, oriented the movement in the United States in a September 2, 1933 article in The Militant, writing, "We must march with this instinctive movement and influence it from within." While the NRA was no pro-labor policy, and in fact set up production codes that exempted industries from antitrust regulations, established near-starvation minimum wages, and upheld the employer's right to victimize union members, nevertheless, union organizers were able to use the NRA to conduct union drives and enroll new members. Thanks to Canada's foresight and guidance, the American Trotskyist movement was well positioned to do so. Despite the AFL leadership's treachery, the spark kindled in 1933 was fanned by revolutionary organizers in 1934 when three definitive strikes led by American leftists gave inspiration to the founding of the CIO. These included the three Trotskyist-led Minneapolis Teamster strikes in February, May, and the summer of 1934, the April 1934 Toledo Autolites strike led by A.J. Mustey's American Workers' Party, which would soon fuse with the American Trotskyists, and a particularly bloody July 1934 West Coast waterfront strike, culminating in a general strike in San Francisco led by militants from the Stalinized Communist Party. And I particularly recommend my friend Brian Palmer's book, Revolutionary Teamsters, The Minneapolis Trucker Strikes of 1934, to anyone wanting to get a flavor of what revolutionary Marxist work in unions and among the unemployed during the New Deal era was actually like. Trotsky himself saw the New Deal initiative as inseparably linked to the specter of class struggle, repeatedly emphasizing that the present policy of the White House is determined by the profound crisis of North American capitalism and the growth of radical tendencies in the working class. These new tendencies have found their clearest expression until now in the form of the CIO. Just to sort of continue the story of the New Deal, Chris Knox writing again, accepted at the depth of the crisis as a necessary evil, the NRA was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1935 because its regulatory codes were considered a drag on free enterprise. In the same year, Roosevelt announced the end of all federal aid to relief, although official estimates showed only half the eligible unemployed were on the dole in the first place. Responsibility for maintaining the jobless was dumped back on the virtually bankrupt states and localities, as under Hoover, producing a new round of demonstrations in state capitals protesting the relief cuts. I know I'm short on time, so I'm gonna just skip ahead a little bit, but the Trotskyists were very involved at first in coalitions with the Socialist Party, which they entered shortly thereafter, and with the Communist Party in unemployed councils. And there was a sort of devastating betrayal that took place by the Stalinists following the zigzag through the Popular Front period, in which the Stalinists basically went overnight from declaring that the New Deal work project administration programs were a new form of slavery because of the starvation minimum wages they paid to saying that anyone that criticized the New Deal policies was in league with the fascists and was trying to undercut democracy. personal anecdote about this. My grandfather ended up by being the oldest of five children with a father who was disabled and had moved up after the coal mine wars to upstate New York. And two of his brothers went into the Work Project Administration programs doing timber work in the Adirondacks. And he was fed up with trying to farm and suggested that he would maybe like to join his brothers doing the timber work. And they said, don't come here, whatever you do, don't go anyplace else. The conditions are terrible, and I've seen that better. So I just want to close by pointing out the way we really see the Depression as ending, and say the American economy blossomed on the industrial appetite of the arms industry, and the American century was later founded on post-war spending linked to Reconstruction following the barbarism and mass destruction of the World War. I'll close with yet another quote from Trotsky, which I think sums up the abject failure of the New Deal and suggests why the AOCs of the world are wrong to try to claim the mantle of the New Deal. In the Manifesto of the Fourth International on Peerless War and Proletarian World Revolution, drafted by Trotsky and adopted by the Emergency Conference of the Fourth International, held at the end of May 1940, Trotsky offered his final postmortem on the American experiment. The New Deal and the Good Neighbor policies were the final attempts to postpone the climax by ameliorating the social crisis through concessions and agreements. After the bankruptcy of this policy, which swallowed up tens of billions, nothing else remained for American imperialism but to resort to the method of the nailed fist. Under one or another pretext and slogan, the United States will intervene in the tremendous clash in order to maintain its world dominion.
This is strange, the way they have this this so low, but my apologies. So my task here was to talk about the Communist Party and the sad story of the largest of the Communist organizations. But I thought that it's useful to put it into the context, really, of what the New Deal was. So this is going to get brighter, but I'm just going to start. You know, it's important to remember what a crisis the Great Depression was. Not just for the capitalist class, but for the working class, right? And you know, the Great Depression was a worldwide crisis, but it was particularly acute in the United States. You can see these unemployment statistics. Only Germany, right, which in 1933, 35% of Germans voted for the Nazi Party, right? So this gives you a sense of the state of the crisis, in the political economic crisis in the United States. Roosevelt announces a New Deal, whatever this is, right? No one knows exactly what he means. At the Democratic Convention in 1932, and eventually it meant these four things, and I'm going to go through them one at a time. So first of all, relief. Just putting money in people's pockets to avoid starvation, to try to mitigate the story of the Hoover bills, right? I mean, this is from the standpoint of both relief, but also from, you know, Roosevelt doesn't want to be Hoover, right? And classically, this was just let's get people out and they'll dig ditches and fill them back up. Roosevelt was a big believer in the idea that you had to work for your relief check. He thought that otherwise it was the dole. So you go out and you work and you stuff mattresses or you dig ditches. But you know, there's no real logic to this, right? If you're gonna spend money, you should spend it on economic development. And that's what the New Deal becomes in the sense of the infrastructure, right? When Green New Dealers talk about infrastructure development, this is it, right? So in New York, right, things like the East River Drive or the Lincoln Tunnel or the E&F trains out to Queens were New Deal money. And you know, I call this unprofitable. Of course, in society as a whole, this was very profitable. This was very useful, right? But unprofitable in the sense of these projects that were beyond the scale of private capitalism or beyond the ability of private capitalism to capture the profits. Public housing, rural economic development. So classically, you know, we all know about the TVA, and here's the woman still pumping water by hand, right? Which is what tens of millions of people were still doing in the 1930s. I love this picture, right? This is rural electrification. And look at them, they're standing there in the middle of the plains, all the power you want, a dream come true. I mean, we should not, you know, we should understand what a massive change to have a refrigerator, right, or to have a light bulb was for these tens of billions of people. Culture and education, here we're back in New York, Lehman College, Highbridge School, the Central Park Zoo are all WPA projects. Now, economic reorganization and regulation. Jason already talked a little bit about the NRA, so I won't say too much about it. It was corporatism, as we would now call it. It was an attempt by government to get monopoly capital to organize itself, to limit production, and therefore to be able to raise prices. And antitrust laws were actually waived to allow them to like sit in a room together, right, and organize production against, frankly, small capitalists as well as workers. Workers were supposed to be given the right to organize, but that was routinely violated. More standard type of regulation that we're familiar with now, things like the FDIC and the SEC, to limit speculation, to restore trust in banks and Wall Street. This is kind of the Warren approach, right? Let's regulate capitalism to make it work better, more efficiently, less speculatively. Oh, just look at this stamp, right? The idea is all Americans like working together, right? In a common determination, it says. That's what the NRA was framed as, right? So at first the Communist Party denounced the New Deal. They called it social fascism. This followed, on the one hand, it followed the Communist International's, the Comintern's 1928 analysis that capitalism was on the ropes in crisis and that communists should not support social democracy, the socialist parties, and so on, because the revolutionary upsurge was imminent. After all, right, if we think of the Democrats as the New Deal Democrats as that iteration in the United States, yes, but they were also the party of the KKK and lynchings, right? This was a big chunk of the Democratic Party was Southern white supremacy, right? And in fact, most early New Deal legislation, as Jason said, was intended to prop up monopoly capitalism, right? But that starts to change in 1935, and there's two things going on. On the one hand, right, the Comintern, after the rise of Hitler, adopts a new policy, the policy of the Popular Front of all democratic forces against fascism. And simultaneously, Roosevelt and the Democratic Party were moving to what we might vaguely call the left, right? It's like if we think of the moderate wing, the quote unquote moderate wing of the Democratic Party versus the left wing, right? So this is based on pressure from below. Right, and so for example, here's Huey Long. Well, he wasn't from below, right? And Long is a problematic figure, but the idea of every man a king was based on this vague idea that there was going to be mass redistribution of wealth. Here's Francis Townsend, a predecessor of Social Security, a much more radical form. He simply said every person over 65 should receive $100 a month. That was a lot of money then. As long as they went out and spent it. So this becomes, of course, Social Security, which is a tamped down version of the Townsend Plan. The Fair Labor Standards Act is also worth talking about. Minimum wages, overtime rules, prohibition of child labor. But, you know, we should understand how limited these programs were too. So for example, healthcare was taken out of the final Social Security bill. Agricultural workers and domestic workers, that is housekeepers and such, were excluded from, in other words, blacks and women, right? Were excluded from both of these bills, right? There was no minimum wage for agricultural workers. There was no minimum wage for a maid or a cook. More issues of limitations, right? The Agricultural Adjustment Act was meant to put money in the hands of farmers to get them not to grow crops. But in the South, where agriculture was based on tenant farming, the landlords took that money, put it in their own pockets, threw the tenant farmers off the land without giving them any piece of it. The Communist Party was down in the South trying to organize the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, met with tremendous terror, right? A government did nothing about it. Other limitations, right? It's important to understand that if you're giving relief based on digging ditches and filling them back up, who's excluded? Women, right? We're in the home. Redlining, right, is a product of the New Deal as well. So on the one hand, right, federally guaranteed home loans, but on the other hand, restricted functionally by race and by color, right? And here it says the heavy Negro, this is Wichita, right? This is New York or something. The heavy Negro concentration of Wichita, and those are the redlined areas where loans were not allowed. In a sense, this kind of, you know, give and put with limitations is epitomized in the GI Bill, right? Which on the one hand is a massive redistribution program to a certain section of the working class. But it excludes women, of course, by definition, since so few women were in the armed forces, and it functionally excluded African Americans who simply did not have, you know, you couldn't buy a house, so you can't use home loans, right? There are a few colleges who accept them, so you can't use the education components. Now, of course, the National Labor Relations Act is also part of the New Deal, and this is the basis on which pressure mounts on the CP to really, like, participate in the New Deal and support it. So on the one hand, right, there's rank and file members, right, and rank and file supporters that are, like, excited, right? This is reformism, yes, but they see it as, you know, the party should be in the unions, should be organizing in the unions. And the party also didn't want to be not just in the rank and file of the unions, but wanted to run these unions. And the price of admission to that, the price of the alliance with John Lewis and the CIO was the support for the New Deal, was the support for Roosevelt. And finally, of course, you know, the Comintern in Moscow were in favor of this alliance as well. Now, as Jason said, the Depression really ends with the war, and I just want to finish with kind of this anecdote about, you know, we'll come back and we can talk about whether this is abject reformism or whether it was a pathway to socialism, if it hadn't been contorted, but certainly during the war, it is contorted. Just to end with this, so there was a massive capital strike at the start of World War, how many minutes?
1 minute.
At the start of World War II, the United States government winds up doing most of the investment during the war in what we would call the commanding heights of the economy, steel, aluminum, aircraft, electrical generation, but the sea, and many left New Dealers wanted the government to hold this after the war and keep it in some form of government hands, but the CP was against this. Why? Because they had gone over to this analysis that there was going to be class amity after the war, that all the classes were going to work together and to talk about nationalism, for example, would be to disrupt this amity. And I'll just leave with the last quote, even discussing government ownership, they wrote, might cause, quote, sharp class conflict, horrors, and would bring division into the camp of national unity. That was the level to which the CP had sunk by the end of World War II.
So, Jack Ross.
Oh, well, I don't have a lot to add to quote Jason and Mark on what the New Deal was and was not. One thing I wasn't mentioned about the NRA was the significant degree to which it was modeled on Mussolini. lady. And I do need to make one correction. Unintended Farming Union was a project of the Socialist Party, not the Communist Party. They did have a rival organization that was less well known. So I want to begin my discussion focusing more on, I guess, the later New Deal and. And also, to a great extent, following on Mark's presentation, talk more about how the myth of the Popular Front really is completely omnipresent over the whole history of the American left, and what alternative model really has any resonance, and that includes with much of the more intellectual and sectarian left in the last analysis. So let me begin by reading a Socialist Party statement from the convention in 1938 that follows on a lot of what Jason and Mark covered. And this is written in 1938 at the peak of Popular Front and collaboration by the Communist Party. The fundamental reason for the New Deal attitude of comparative friendliness to labor is its perspective. The New Deal is interested in preserving the capitalist system. While individual capitalists think mainly in terms of immediate profit and commercial advantage, the New Deal originally encouraged labor's efforts to secure greater purchasing power because it understood that only that method could alleviate the depression and allow capitalism to stabilize itself in a world facing economic collapse. The perspective of the New Deal is expressed even more clearly now in the international situation because the New Deal is tied to the defense of capitalism and capitalism breeds war. The New Deal has become a streamlined instrument for war preparations. The New Deal and the Communist Party are both attempting to strengthen the war machine. Now, I want to largely leave aside the question of whether the alternative path the socialists were still at that late date seeking, which is basically a electoralist social democratic path, which would have in the last analysis for a closer resemblance to a New Deal agencies or programs than to the kind of revolutionary socialist model Trotsky would have been envisioning in the quotes Justin Jason gave. And obviously there's also a much bigger question, far too big for our purposes today, whether even at the late date of this quote 1938, such a socialist alternative to the New Deal could have still prevented the Second World War, kept America out of it. But this does also, in an important way, not only come back to my main mission in, or among my main missions within my book on the Socialist Party, but on my forthcoming book on American exceptionalism, the death of American exceptionalism, deals with a more general American history, political patterns of political realignment, and one work that is critical to my new book is a book that was written by Samuel Huntington in the early 1980s, and the title is American Politics, Promise of Disharmony. But he talks about the cycle of creedal passion Revolutionary War, abolitionists in the Civil War, progressive era in the 1960s. And this is also in keeping with a lot of scholarship of the so-called Wisconsin School of James Weinstein, Gabriel Kolko. The progressive era really was what set the tone of American political economy, with World War I war's fulfillment, not the New Deal. The New Deal was would everything, all of the fundamental, everything that was set, was fundamentally set during the corporatist revolution of the progressive era. And so I want to read a quote from Huntington about why the New Deal was not a critical passion period. The primary concern of the New Deal was not the reform of politics, but the restoration of prosperity. Unlike most critical passion periods, the 1930s was a period of economic depression. The need to deal with economic problems meant that the emphasis was on how to use government power, not how to break it up. Although New Deal rhetoric incorporated Jacksonian and populist criticism of the malefactors of great wealth, the principal imperatives of the New Deal were directed toward the solution of immediate and pressing economic problems through governmental action if necessary, rather than the reshaping of political and economic institutions to bring them into accord with the ideals of the American free. The New Deal never manifested any sustained and consistent hostility to the two great ogres of the progressive era, the machines and the trusts. Almost totally absent from the New Deal were the moralism and puritanism characteristic of creedal passion periods. Now, my thesis in this intersection of the SP book and my forthcoming book is that basically the myth of the Popular Front can essentially be reduced to the fallacy that the New Deal, in fact, was a creedal passion period, that the Popular Front were the abolitionists or radical Republicans. To be sure, this began as the story the communists told about themselves at the time, and but being an actually existing party of the Communist International always carried a good deal of cynicism. It was later generations, spurred on by the mass of party defectors from the Khrushchev period, who did so much to set the tone of the American left beginning in the 1970s. They very sincerely believed this, and this is and that's basically what has gotten us to where to the kind of senescence. I had not heard the phrase before. For what was it?
The Mandela effect. Yeah.
How do you spell it?
M A N D E.
Oh, is it? Oh, as in Nelson Mandela. Okay.
Named after Nelson Mandela because there was a false memory that Nelson Mandela had died.
Oh.
So.
Oh.
Yep.
Okay. That very good.
Became popular in spread.
So, I did want to say a few words about a lot of the core theses of Platypus and his program that about the death of the left in 1919, and that fundamentally the task that was abandoned then was of completing the bourgeois revolution and what began with the Popular Front and just metastasized over time through that Mandela effect was basically the confirmation of that abandonment of completing the bourgeois revolution. In the specific case of the Socialist Party, their historic platform or model was of what they called the immediate demands in their platform, which included not only what we think of as the basic reformist aims of social democracy and trade unionism, but also of the basic aims of the bourgeois revolution of increasing democracy, threat democracy, and I would say that to the extent that many of those of the 1930s socialists who became the founders of Cold War liberalism, or certainly the better half of Cold War liberalism, though it was at that same time at the time of my first quote in 1938, that they were still very radically anti-war, among other things. They were already beginning to abandon they were already retreating from the model of immediate demands into welfare statism, but still that idea of the positive values of anti-communism, basic civil libertarianism, and I guess I'm to wrap up by saying that the task of the left now, which you see in many populist movements emerging across the West, is to once again take up that task of completing the bourgeois revolution.
Marxist thought, particularly hegemonic Marxist thought. The Great Depression provided the greatest challenge to the dominant position of the capitalist class in the United States since the consolidation of power during the American Civil War. Between 1929 and 1932, the Industrial Production Index dropped by more than half. By the end of the following year, the unemployment rate plummeted to nearly 25%. The collective trauma of the American bourgeoisie was heightened by the unprecedented rate of economic development produced by the self-declared anti-capitalist Soviet Union. Accelerated industrialization, centrally orchestrated by the state under multiple five-year plans, led to the tripling of Soviet industrial production from 1929 to 1940. Unemployment was practically non-existent. While much of this rapid modernization was made possible by a brutally violent exploitation that made a mockery of communist ideals, what was most significant for contemporary American politics was not the inherent contradiction of Stalinism, but the manner in which its legitimate successes further exposed the failings of liberal capitalism. According to the historian Eric Hobsbawm, the achievements of the Soviet Union during the Great Depression, quote, impressed foreign observers of all ideologies. The international geopolitical situation, combined with the collapse of the American political economy, produced social upheaval across the United States. Workers collectively organized at a dramatic rate as union membership grew by 775,000 in the second half of 1933, despite massive levels of unemployment. FDR's first iteration of the New Deal was primarily composed of temporary reforms that failed to overcome the crisis, as you've heard from multiple of the panelists. However, a tidal wave of strikes led by militant radicals in 1934 smashed the balance of forces in the country towards the working class. After a failed attempt at negotiations with ownership, thousands of laborers walked off the job at the Autolite factory in Toledo, Ohio. Their innovative tactics, particularly building a coalition with the unemployed, proved fruitful. Thousands of people joined the picket lines in solidarity, despite the violent onslaught of the police and National Guard, who murdered two men for supporting the strike. Open class warfare ended in proletarian victory in Toledo as Autolite and the union reached an agreement that included a 5% wage increase as well as union recognition. Further to the northwest in Minneapolis, 3,000 Teamster truck drivers launched a strike that spread rapidly across the city. Within a week, an estimated 35,000 building trades workers joined the action in solidarity. In the aftermath of police opening fire on the striking Teamsters, the union newspaper declared itself prepared to fight out on the picket line it takes all summer. That same summer, some of these have already been mentioned, but a coastwide longshore strike organized and led by the International Longshoremen Association paralyzed all major ports up and down the Pacific coast. In San Francisco, police killed two striking dock workers in what became to be known as Bloody Thursday. In response, all union laborers walked off their jobs and shut down the city for a four-day general strike. On the other side of the country, on the eastern seaboard, 400,000 textile workers launched a strike in September against provisions in the National Recovery Act that favored management in their industry. At the height of the Great Depression, from mid-1933 through 1934, around 2.5 million men and women went on strike in demand for higher pay and more just working conditions. At the same time, unions sprang up by the thousands. Perhaps most significantly, organizing drives occurred in workplaces where campaigns had never been successful before. The development of working class institutions was not limited to labor unions. In New York in the 1930s, the United Council of Working Class Women organized against the rising cost of living. Their butcher shop boycott was one of the most remarkably successful campaigns. The action was led by veteran organizer Claire Shalison, who built a coalition between the communist-led United Council of Working Class Women and non-communist women's groups, including the Neighborhood Mothers Club, church groups, and black women's groups, in order to overcome religious and racial divisions. As a result of their collective action, over 1,000 shops throughout New York City reduced their meat prices. By the end of the summer, its success inspired women to boycott meat in all cities across the country. Working class rebellion created a political climate in which a business-friendly New Deal had the potential to be transformed into a new social contract. As demonstrated by the aforementioned murder of striking workers by the police and National Guard throughout 1934, Capitol and their allies in the state refused to retreat quietly into the night. Congressman Hamilton Fish of New York unleashed his red baiting campaign early in the Great Depression, especially as the Communist Party USA gained traction in the labor movement. The House Committee to Investigate Communist Activities called FBI Director Hoover to testify. He warned about the persuasive power of Marxist propaganda and the need to outlaw revolutionary words if Congress seriously intended to challenge the supposed red menace. The committee proved to be a spectacular failure that concluded with an enraged Congressman Fish lashing out against the incompetence of the government. Throughout the next decade, workers on the march and the red flag flying in American skies unlike any other time in the nation's history. From 1930 to 1939, membership in the Communist Party USA skyrocketed from 6,822 to 66,000. Considering the nature of the institution, a disciplined cadre organization that required serious commitment from its membership, its rapid expansion reveals the extent to which radical politics shaped American society during the Great Depression. In this environment, propagandists painted all labor organizing with a red brush in an effort to undermine the development of institutions rooted in worker power. State and local governments waged an assault on the labor movement. In Alabama, Birmingham, and Bessemer criminalized possession of union publications. Over 100 strikers were killed during the first 3 years of Roosevelt's administration, while 18,000 were locked behind bars. Capitalists developed associations such as the Sentinels of the Republic and the American Liberty League to spread the anti-communist gospel. Corporations spent approximately $80 million to hire secret agents to spy on labor organizers. White supremacist death squads demonstrated their allegiance to the American bourgeoisie. The Black Legion, a Midwestern offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan, murdered at least 10 union organizers in 1934 and 1935. Capital's brazen strategy of counter-revolutionary terror ultimately backfired as public sentiment demanded the Roosevelt administration partner with working class organizations to craft a second New Deal. The revolt of labor gave birth to a new movement that would permanently alter the organizational structure of the United States federal government. At the center of the social transformation was the National Labor Relations Act, more popularly known as the Wagner Act. Legislation guaranteed employees the right to form and join unions, and legally compelled employers to bargain collectively with unions as exclusive representatives of all workers if a majority of the employees had voted to join the organization. The Wagner Act also created the National Labor Relations Board to protect the rights of labor through the enforcement mechanism of the federal support system. I could get into the contradictions in that, but I guess that's a later discussion. Less than 2 months later, the Social Security Act was signed into law. While its original design was discriminatory and provisions were insufficient for a dignified life, the establishment of, quote, a system of federal old age benefits in order to provide for the general welfare represented a dramatic expansion of social rights in the United States. It raised the public's expectation for what they were owed by society. More specifically, both pieces of legislation signaled that the United States government no longer exclusively operated on behalf of property-owning classes. We'll see how that goes as time goes on. But at the same time, Congress significantly increased taxes on corporations and the rich while breaking up private monopolies with the Public Utility Holding Company Act. Additionally, the Work Projects Administration filled the void of the class of free market by employing more than 3 million workers by early 1936. While the jobs program did not outlast the Roosevelt administration, the fruits of its labor are still forming the infrastructural backbone of many American communities in the 21st century. Their accomplishments range from the construction and renovation of 8,000 parks to the development of 16,000 new water line, 650,000 miles of new or improved roads. They also produced 382 million articles of clothing and served 1.2 billion school lunches. By the end of the decade, the United States had been dramatically transformed into a social democracy, albeit tepid, by counter-hegemonic struggles, working class institutions who forced capitalism and the state to capitulate out of genuine fear of a more widespread revolution. Now, briefly, just back to the present moment and the current utterance and popularization of the Green New Deal by figures like Ocasio-Cortez and also Bernie Sanders' utilization of the New Deal to push forward a vision of democratic socialism in the 21st century. While I have a number of critiques of his speech from the other day, in particular his use of corporate socialism to describe what capitalism has always been, what's most critical to understand what he's trying to do and how radicals can take advantage of the current resurgence of socialist politics in the United States is to think about Eric Hobsbawm's introductory essay to the invention of tradition. What Hobsbawm talks about there is a feature of modernity, which is how these traditions, these histories that people across the political spectrum utilize, even though they don't perfectly reflect the reality of history. FDR and the top government officials orchestrating the New Deal were not socialists. But there is a lot to draw from in the New Deal period, in particular, the development of these institutions that were able to exert power on behalf of the working class to make real gains and concessions. Now, with this new Green New Deal that people are talking about, I think it's very critical to think about how radicals can utilize this space and utilize the popularization of socialism in the mainstream discourse and perhaps the, I would say, social democrats taking power in the state or, you know, seizing influence in the state to put out policies that can kind of put the boot off of working class people and enable them more space to develop these working class institutions that can then exert power for themselves and eventually push for a broader revolution. And I don't think we're going to have one moment of eruption. The revolution is going to take, it's going to be a series of back and forth struggles, revolution, counter-revolution, and it's going to be a complex process. That's all I have to say.
Great, so now we'll have responses.
One thing I didn't have time to talk about, but I'm glad came up, was the role that the Dixiecrats played in the New Deal Alliance and pointing out that healthcare didn't even, you know, emerge as a final reform was largely based on the fact that in the South, the Dixiecrats absolutely refused to entertain the idea of integrated hospitals. It does show what the Rooseveltian coalition was really made up and consisted of. I think talking about social democracy, and I would disagree that the New Deal resulted in a social democracy in the US, but one of the main reasons why a mass social democratic movement never emerged had to do with the role of racism in the US. But it's also true that, in a certain sense, the illusions in Roosevelt at this critical period ended up by substituting for social democracy. Fanon wrote, the New Deal of Roosevelt was a substitute for the social reform program of social democracy in the past. That was the basis of its hold on workers. And I did talk about some of the disillusionments in the strikes, but you know, nevertheless, it remains true that there was substantial illusions and substantial electoral support for Roosevelt from large sectors of the working class. One aspect of that, to be honest, was the Stalinist betrayal. And, you know, I want to give the Communist Party its due. There was some impressive work that was done among the unemployed, among tenant farmers. I remember when I first was investigating Marxism, reading Mark Mason's book on communists in Harlem. And when you read about the work that the CP was doing on the ground, on evictions, occupations of city buildings demanding increased unemployment benefits, increased welfare. That was impressive rank and file work. But ultimately, there was also a sectarianism and the shifting of lines. And the Socialist Party, the Trotskyists, and the Communist Party were at one point all doing work in organizing WPA workers. And there was in 1936 to 39, when the support shifted over to, when the Stalinist Party line shifted over to support Roosevelt, there was a bureaucratic purge of the Workers' Alliance, which was what they were all in. 17 locals were either expelled in New York City or quit and formed an unemployed and project workers' union, then competing with the CP organization, which by that point was telling people, you have to follow the president, you have to follow the mayor, they're the ones that are doing the organizing. The mayor was Mayor LaGuardia, who was sort of the Bill de Blasio of his day. And his quote was, take WPA jobs or go to jail. the CP line on the Unemployed Project Workers Union was that nothing could be done in coalition that with them, that you had to ignore this corrupt group of Trotskyites and remain faithful to the alliance. I'll leave it there. I want to leave time for questions. So.
There's a lot of useful stuff up here. I just want to, so a couple of things. None of us really got to the post-war period. And despite talking about the delusions of the CP, it's worth remembering that the year after the war was the year of the largest strike wave in American working class history. Right, and it was a fight to preserve and extend the working class aspects of the New Deal after World War II, which was met by repression, Truman militarizing certain industries to demand that workers go back to work. It was met by McCarthyism. It was met by the Taft-Hartley Act, which severely restricted the rights of workers under NLRA. So, I mean, in this context of that, there was a fight after World War II, but it was met by severe repression of various kinds. The Soviet comparison is very good and very relevant to talk about, right? That this was, that all the leftist groups at the time, you know, were talking about, see, this is what socialism could be, this is what communism could be, right? And it's a talking point for them at the time. The Wagner Act, you know, is an interesting legislation because on the one hand, it does make unionization and stable unionization more possible, right? But on the other hand, it's very much seen by the New Dealers as a regularization of the relationships between corporations and the working class, and the government is going to step in and regulate this relationship and keep it kind of at the level of collective bargaining and no more. And finally, you know, what should we do? It's all, I think, the point of this is what should we do if we are, you know, so fortunate as that the left wing of the Democratic Party is able to declare victory in 2020, right? And how do we deal with, and of course, Jack reminds us that it'll still be pulled rightward, right, as well. But there'll be all sorts of rightist forces that even if that left wing comes to power, will be trying to pull it back right. And we've got to be pulling from the other direction. And the question is, how do you support what's useful, and how will we support, let's say, the transition away from fossil fuels, which is, you know, absolutely necessary, right? Without spreading fallacies, the kind of fallacies that were spread in the late 30s by the CP especially, about that this is the way forward.
I guess my one critical comment would have to do with as Jason alluded to, the characterization of the New Deal or the became a part of the New Deal as a kind of social democracy. I mean, calling it a social democracy really is only a conceit that emerged among certain left-wing historians beginning in the 70s and later to obscure the fact that that what they were talking about was a Communist Party program in the early post-war years, that this bit and the conceit and a very misleading conceit that that social democracy was the thing that was being suppressed by McCarthyism. I just want to touch on one or two just historical points or questions to the other panelists. Jason, I thought of a mention earlier when you talked about the ill-fated alliance of sort, if you can call it that, between the SP and the Trotskyists. I do not recall the specific details offhand. There are a few copies of my book on sale at the Platypus Table, and I could look in there. But it began very largely as part of the process of expelling the Trotskyists, the move away from the immediate demands formula and internal party democracy toward welfare state liberalism. And Mark, I'm very curious to ask you, I had never heard before of the Harold Ickes proposal of 1944 and the communists, and I assume Browder's response to it. I don't know if you or anyone else in the room read the book, 2013, The New History of the Henry Wallace Campaign, and it talked about, it did not seem quite right to me, this revisionism about exactly what the Soviets really wanted and what the miscommunications were with the American Party. It suggested, oh, if only they had stayed in the Democratic Party or in the mainstream labor movement instead of splitting, just thinking, well, that doesn't really seem possible. That's strange to me, but I think of that in connection to the Ickes plan. Was that a factor in the expulsion of Browder, and what the Soviets really wanted was for something like the Ickes plan to come into effect and for the communists to simply keep the footing that they had and under the, and then when Browder went too far by being too class collaborationist against it. Can you speak to that at all?
I can.
One minute.
Right. What?
You have 1 minute.
Oh, yeah, no, then I'm done. Yeah.
So this question of Browder and William C. Foster and the CP.
Yeah.
Foster is able to post an article in New Masses, which was a theoretical journal, in early 44, calling for nationalization, but immediately sat down by the party leadership as a whole, and he's pushed out of the informal leadership position that it had. I don't think that Browder's expelled because of the reaction to the Ickes plan. I think it's just, you know, the tide is turning.
Well, obviously there's a bigger picture, but yeah. It just struck me as a very important part of the story, and also because, as I mentioned, the suggestions of that was it Tom Devine? I don't remember the author's name, but it's a very clunky title. It was published in 2013. Yeah, I guess that. But anyway, thanks.
Jack.
I just want to address the critiques of my using the term social democracy. I also clarify that it's the tepid and the most tepid version of social democracy possible. I'm not thinking that, like, ideally what people were calling it at the time. I'm looking at it in terms of its material construction, which is that it helped integrate parts of working class power into the state apparatus in the same way that European social democracies did that. And I'm specifically referring to the National Labor Relations Act and the kind of integration of the union bureaucracy into maybe not elements of the ruling class, but as a faction of the working class that cooperates with the ruling class to manage capitalist relations. That's all I have to say.
All right, so we'll open it up to the floor. Richard.
Yeah, Jason raised the question of race and racism in terms of the failure. And so I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, but I mean, the height of a mass socialist party would have been around 1912, right? So I've never quite seen how you can explain the failure of the socialist party in many ways, but racism doesn't seem to me a particularly plausible explanation for it in terms of that crisis. And I guess what I would like to take off on that is nowadays, in the present moment on the left, there seems to be sort of the opposite anxiety, at least rhetorically, that the white working class has become reactionary. So I guess that what I would like is a sort of conversation about how you see race as playing into the original New Deal and how you see race as playing into social democratic politics today.
Does anybody want to
ask? Oh, I didn't really address.
Are you going to take several questions?
No, we'll take one at a time.
Okay. Well, since you asked me directly, I'll speak first and if anyone else wants to go. What I think I mean when I'm talking about, racism having prevented the rise of a mass sort of social democratic consciousness is really that in the U.S. as opposed to European countries, et cetera, the legacy of slavery was that you had a working class that was divided with a lot of white workers, falsely, sort of seeing themselves as having a degree of privilege vis-a-vis black workers and the ruling class being able to exploit racism to keep the working class divided. And that's, everywhere you see it from the importation of black workers from the South into meatpacking factories in Chicago to schemes to put black and white workers next to each other on the assembly line in auto plants. I mean, people think of Ford as being, progressive, for being willing to hire black workers, but a part of his plan was apparently also thinking that this would prevent unionization in his factories. It didn't ultimately work, but nonetheless, it did have, a retarding effect on the ability to forge a socialist party. That,
if you could form interracial unions, why couldn't you form an interracial socialist party?
I think you could, but I think one of the issues, and somebody even as good as Debs in the Socialist Party, said that there was nothing special that the Socialist Party had to offer black workers. Without recognizing the role of the special oppression and becoming sort of a tribune and being willing to address issues that affected black workers as extra exploited and specially oppressed, I think that it failed to recruit masses of black workers, and therefore you had the impossibility, or not the impossibility, I don't want to say impossibility, but the difficulty of organizing in the South. So you had a whole part of the country in which a lot of unionization was prevented, and then you had racial tensions in the North, even at the period that you're talking about, in the 19-teens being the height. I mean, that's when you've got race pogroms going on in urban cities. And it is primarily white workers who are participating in the lynchings of black workers, and it's over a false view of competition for jobs, right? And black workers moving into working class neighborhoods. The other way that racism, xenophobia, anyways, played in was anti-immigrant hysteria, and that's something that we're definitely seeing being replayed today, and a part of the basis of Trump's base. And I don't think the real fascistic types actually, believe Trump has their program any more than a lot of us believe that Bernie Sanders represents our program, but he sort of gives them cover to percolate up out of the sewers, I don't want to write off the white working class as racist the way some Maoists do, because I do think that a lot of this is a false consciousness. That in reality, the legacy of racism has been to depress the wages of white workers as well. and that there have been, you know, great examples of solidarity on the picket lines, and those examples are still continuing today when we look at the Wayfair walkout, you know? So, but I'll leave it there. I know other people
want to. Two others want to respond?
Well, just to speak directly to the question, without taking anything away from what's unique in the history of American racism, the heterogeneity of American working class goes far beyond that. And in what kind, when people talk about the unique legacy of racism as far as national solidarity or whatever, I mean, where in the world do you have that kind of social democratic consciousness in any other country, frankly? And I guess I would just then also take the opportunity to say something about the Green New Deal. I was in France recently reading about the Gilets Jaunes protests and people saying, oh, these are completely disparate aims, all contradictory with each other, and from what I read, that's not the case. That what unites them is a crisis or oppression or division of class division of built environment, and that's the main thing to me. The Green New Deal needs to address, whether it's in this country or abroad. And I mean, I argue in my forthcoming book that built environment is the key distinguishing factor between the red and blue tribes, and the contrary to so much of present-day leftist analysis about politics and gentrification, racism is much more symptom than cause of, or racial disparity rather is much more symptom than cause of that disparity of built environment, and the idea that you shouldn't just. You need to read Engels on the housing question as far as the problem of anti-gentrification politics.
I just want to slightly disagree with it merely being a false consciousness issue. That there are real material benefits to being white in the United States as opposed to not being white. And I think it's important to factor that into our analysis, that we need to deal with people's particular oppressions, how the capitalist ruling class is most violently attacking them, understand that, meet them where they are, and build power in that sense. I'm opposed to certain factions of the left that consider organizing against police violence or prison abolition as some sort of distraction from mass actions. I think those are critical fronts in building working class power. In terms of, I don't think the white working class is all reactionary. I think that's a very blanket statement. I think actually Trump's primary base, obviously other than the capitalists who are backing him, are the plethora of petty bourgeois property owners over the age of 60 who are a dominant force in the American electorate. That is Trump's main base.
Do you think that's enough to get in the
market? Considering that basically half the American population does not vote, yes. I think that was he pulled in some aspects of like the white working class, but most people whose incomes were under 50,000 did not vote in the last election.
So on the one hand, going back to the New Deal, right, there were race riots, anti-black race riots during World War II, about housing desegregation, about opening up craft jobs in the industry to black people after the Federal Employment Practices Commission was set up. But on the other hand, right, this is, I criticized the CP before, but this is where the CP is best. Right, and CP took a firm anti-racist position. They supported the Black Belt South to the extent of supporting the right of blacks in the Black Belt South, where they were in the vast majority for national self-determination. At the cost, right, at political cost to to themselves of doing the right thing. And in the factories where they were working, and in the unions where they were dominant, they took a firm anti-racist position. And, you know, workers, and workers accepted it, right? Workers accepted it because, it, just as I said, what was the price of admission for the CP, right? Well, this was the price of admission for workers to these unions, right? Workers, you have to accept that you stand side by side with your African American brothers and sisters.
The New Deal took a turn
to the left in 1935. And it was that year that Social Security was adopted, and the National Labor Relations Act, which was which was different from Section 7A of the NRA Code, because it outlawed company unions and set up the National Labor Relations Board. Now, you've mainly portrayed this as a response to the industrial struggles that took place, the three winning strikes of 1934, and the unionization wave, but there's another aspect of this that is often overlooked, and that is, in addition to a working class revolt, there was also a middle class revolt. There was a plan to form a third party, to run the Huey Long as a presidential candidate, and that had the support of Charles Francis Townsend, who was mentioned here, basically invented Social Security, and Father Charles Coughlin, not yet a racist anti-Semitic demagogue, but he became shortly after. Now, of course, this was thwarted when Huey Long was assassinated in 1935, but this was another pressure driving Roosevelt to more radical solutions. Now, Jason was saying that the New Deal was a failure. He said that several times. Well, there's no doubt that its aim was to stabilize capitalism by making certain concessions. But are you saying that it failed of this goal? I'm not sure that it did. There were other factors involved, but the pillars of the New Deal survived. Except to the right to organize, which is now largely defunct. It survived for a long time. It had its intended, I would argue anyway, these reforms had their intended stabilizing effect, so in terms of their own aims, the New Deal was not a failure. When we talk about the New Deal, in the Democratic Party, I think you have to take account of the context in which their demands are raised. And that is after 20, 30 years or so of neoliberal hegemony, in which, very unlike the 1930s, in which the ruling classes proclaimed that socialism was dead and gone forever, free markets were the solution to everything, that welfare state programs were useless, and were also fought. Any expansion of the welfare state was fought tooth and nail. And a decline in working class standards of living, and you have these demands raised in a new and very different context. And I would submit that the people in the Democratic Party who are raising them are not your standard breed of Democratic politicians that we have become accustomed to, and that there is a real fight going on. Now, these people are openly reformist. These people do have an idealized version of the New Deal, and it's important to correct that. But I think the main criticism of people who are advocating a return to the New Deal, that with the balance of class forces being what it is, the state of the capitalist economy and the capitalist world being what it is, this goal is not feasible. Mm-hmm.
have the program elect me, and that we will take over the Democratic Party and enact all of these reforms, I think is perhaps just as unrealistic, if not more so, with the possibility of revolution. I don't think you should criticize. I think you have to intercept people who are brought into the DSA by this movement, and I think that is the basis upon which you have to criticize their political goals.
Well, that's an interesting point, Jim, and I'm going to backpedal a little bit. I guess if we say that the point of the New Deal was to stabilize capitalism in the sense of preventing socialist revolution, then the New Deal succeeded admirably. If the point of the New Deal was to fix the U.S. economy and stabilize capitalism in a financial sense, then I stand by the thesis that the New Deal was a failure. One of the Mandela effect things that I was referring to is the conviction that somehow the New Deal was a Keynesian program of stimulation. One of the problems with this theory is that it's an anachronism, that Keynes hadn't even elaborated his theory at the time that FDR was elected into office. Did reforms that came out of the New Deal survive, and were some of those reforms beneficial to the working class in the sense of opening up a space for struggle? That's true, and I if I seem angular in the approach, I was trying to say that, you know, that the emphasis on the right to unionize was something that was exploited by, for instance, the Trotskyists in trying to organize the Teamsters unions. So there was a space opened up by the New Deal, and I don't want to be too dismissive of that. But in terms of the practical effect of the New Deal on the working class, one thing, I'll return just to the WPA thing again. The WPA projects, most of which were make work projects, most of which didn't have actually a benefit like the Tennessee Valley Authority or the construction of the freeways, paid as low as $40 a month in the north and $19 a month in the south. And the reason they paid $19 a month in the south, to return again to the topic, is clearly racism. It's clearly the role that had in depressing wages. But I'll let anybody else take a shot.
Well, just quickly, yes, you're absolutely right that it was the possibility of a national farmer labor party along the lines you described that was a much bigger fear for Roosevelt around the period when he first announced Social Security, among other things, that the communists were. And this is the point that many historians make when it comes to refuting the whole Joe McCarthy 20 years of treason idea about the New Deal, which is the period when the Communist Party tied itself most tightly to the New Deal, which was entirely a function of Soviet foreign policy from the time of the quarantine speech in the fall of 1937 to the Hitler-Stalin Pact almost exactly 2 years later. That came after all of the major reforms of the New Deal and occurred during a period of retrenchment and retreat by the New Deal, the massive Republican gains in the 38 midterm and so forth.
I guess since you mentioned DSA, I have the number here, I should address that. I think it's important to note that, one, DSA is not a democratic centralist organization. It's a big tent with a variety of political perspectives and ideologies, and people who do work in certain spheres that are not always agreed with in others. There's definitely contestation over the direction of the organization, but there's also some agreement in that you go do this electoral work and we'll go work on the base building side of things. So it's like there's a complication here and perhaps a contradiction, but between you know, our most prominent figures that are associated with DSA, even like Sanders is not a member, but he talks about democratic socialism all the time, and there's AOC, Rashida Tlaib, and also here in New York, there's someone like an elected official like Salazar who is openly a Marxist. So there is a variety of perspectives even among the elected officials themselves, but there's also a dramatic difference in the reformist tendencies of the elected officials, the people who focus their work in electoral organizing, and the, I would say, the majority of the people who are committed as organizers in the organization who spend a lot of their time on other sorts of work.
I'll pass. I think my colleagues have said everything. What have said?
Kevin?
Yeah, so I have two questions. So many theorists around the moment of the New Left immediately afterwards, like say the Boer at the Situationists, you have folks like Nathan Glaser and also like New Left theorists like Carl Oglesby, all pointing to the social discontents and the malaise that come around in the in the administered state that's post-New Deal. And so with an eye towards the New Deal, what were the missed opportunities for the New Left to capitulate on this sort of social discontent and malaise and harness it towards the task of world socialism? And
capitalize, right? Capitalize on it.
Yeah. Yes. And the second
question. Did you say New Left, or do you mean the left of the?
The New Left.
Okay.
And the second question is that, so Obama pretty much called for a new New Deal, and of course he didn't get his way. I'm wondering to what extent, say, Sanders, AOC, the millennial left, so with DSA Jacobin, like supersede Obama's and go beyond Obama's demand for a new Deal.
I might just say to begin with, when you were talking about those those WPA figures, I thought about the Obama stimulus, frankly, and I'm not sure what I can add to that. I mean, I guess the extent I have an answer, I would only do what I said earlier about what the focus of a Green New Deal should be, as opposed to a lot of the tacked on identity politics and related demands, again following on what's been illustrated by the Gilles Jean, which is inequality of built environment is the key.
I mean, kind of the classic framing of the New Left and what opportunities were missed, and I don't see any reason to dispute this, is that the New Left at first is very skeptical of the American working class as being even a potentially revolutionary force. You know, analyzes them as born out. Well, they're all working there at Ford and are perfectly happy to get their, you know, with their 2 weeks of vacation and remote. And it's only, and the timing winds up being bad, right? It's only as the 60s come to a close and the 70s start that portions of the New Left say, oh, we should go into the working class, we should talk about socialism, we should talk about communism, we should start to spread it. They really had no, they had to learn on the job how to do this, as it were, because the degeneracy of the CP was largely so much that there were no real links back to the 30s and how to do this, and so it was done often kind of bluntly and not thoughtfully at times. But there was, if you look at the early 70s, there's a whole wave of working class struggles, much around not only about economics, but about conditions of work. And this gets sized down with the 74-75 economic recession, and by the time that's over, well, it's still going on, right? And the left has kind of disappeared as a prime actor by the end of the 70s.
To speak to the second question, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of Jacobin or their caucus, Bread and Roses, because I'm not a member and I have some strategic differences with their approach. But I would say the core difference between a Sanders and Obama candidacy, or the what was happening in the 2000s is now, and now, is that there have been legitimate revolts. There's organization happening now that there really wasn't. And not just talking about TSA, but movements like the Movement for Black Lives, Indigenous struggles at Standing Rock, by Wall Street. There was no real class consciousness or real talk about socialism, I would say, maybe outside of coming from Fox News in the discourse at all. But I think more critically, it's the actual organizations themselves. In particular, you had this recent wave of strikes in this country that we have not seen in decades. 2018 had the highest number of striking workers since the 80s. It needs to obviously expand and grow, and we're seeing this happen now. But there are, I think, real material differences in the situation now than in 2008.
Yes, thank you. First off, from the Bolshevik tendency, as people have pointed out, of course, worker struggles were the background to the New Deal in many ways, as well as the crisis of U.S. capitalism. And I think those struggles were both of organized workers with a union and those who were in the process of forming one, were seeking to have one, because the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, refused to organize masses of industrial workers because they were unskilled. And I personally hate that term, unskilled worker. It suggests people who do a certain type of work do not employ certain skills, when in fact they employ a lot of skills. They're just looked down upon. So they refused to organize the unskilled workers, and they pushed for their own organizations. Of course, as communists, as Trotskyists, we support any and all reforms that might be passed within the capitalist system that are advantageous to the working class in our struggle, whether it is social security reforms, or working hours, or safety legislation, etc., etc. We will support those because the working class will benefit from them. We would be stupid to oppose them, right? But at the same time as saying, yes, these are reforms that will benefit us, we will also point out the limitations of them and the objectives of them. And I think in terms of the New Deal, the objective of the New Deal was to a large extent to stabilize the capitalist system and to bring about some sort of class peace by making some concessions. I want to pick up the term that the comrade from the DSA used, the popularization of socialism, to talk about the New Green Deal in my case. I think we're all in favor of the popularization of socialism. It just depends a little bit what concretely that looks like. So the fact that many people talk about socialism and self-identify as socialists, that's great. The fact that the DSA has grown, I don't know, tenfold to tens of thousands of people is a reflection of that. And while I'm not a supporter of the DSA, I recognize the fact that tens of thousands of people join a supposedly socialist organization means something in the United States. There is a certain shift. We should recognize that. But what I'm not in favor of is a popularization of socialism that sells something like the Green New Deal as a socialist demand or as something that socialists see as a true solution to a huge problem of capitalism and, in fact, the climate. So I think we need to be careful in how we present these things. I think we need to be critical of an idea like the Green New Deal that basically has become so popular that large sections of the business community, as they call themselves, sign up to it because they see a deal in it for them. They can see that they will benefit if these changes are made. Now, do not question some personal good intentions of people who support it because, you know what, the climate is somewhat important. We don't want to fuck up the planet. No, we don't. But is the Green New Deal going to do this? Is it going to help the climate? Is it going to really be a socialist demand that the masses can rally behind? I don't think so, because what it says is we're going to make some changes that will benefit different sections of the bourgeoisie, and it will be to the disadvantage of other sections of the bourgeoisie. policy. It's a shifting in how production and energy consumption should be organized and distributed. It's not touching on capitalism, and I think we need to be clear about it and speak to it, quite frankly. We're not dismissing good intentions, but we need to be clear about the facts. And the Green New Deal is not going to save the planet. It's going to save the bourgeoisie.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
So first of all, I'd like to articulate that the Ocasio-Cortez's version of the Green New Deal is different than DSA's platform, eco-socialist vision of the Green New Deal, which calls for the decommodification of energy, development of locally owned, like solar. I'm not particularly an expert in eco-socialism itself, so I'd be relaying this, but it is about taking that sector of the economy outside of the market. So that is DSA's version of the Green New Deal. And there's efforts to push the legislators to do this. But I also agree that it's not really just going to come about through like well-intentioned people putting in this legislation to change things. It's going to the only way to actually deal with the climate catastrophe is to liquidate fossil capital. And fossil capital is completely integrated into most of the other powerful sectors of the bourgeoisie. I don't think you can actually really transfer one. When you're dealing with fossil capital, it's like trying to deal with Wall Street. It's so intertwined with everything else that's going on that in order to actually confront fossil capital, we have to confront the entire bourgeoisie.
Okay. Clarification, so the DSA or part of the DSA is calling for nationalization of the entire energy sector of the economy?
Nationalization, some forms of it, but also local democratic control of energy systems.
Well, I don't even know what that means. What does it mean in local democratic control of oil
companies? Well, nationalization of the oil company to shut down oil production. But something like a solar farm can be put on your rooftops of an entire community, so the people who live in that area then get to have control over the energy. It's like a cooperative model of energy ownership.
So, I mean, without getting into the weeds of a particular sector, right, and like trying to explain what we would do, what should be done in a particular sector in 30 seconds, right, in a room with 25 people. But I think the larger question is, so let's go back to the 30s for a second. You had workers flooding into, you have workers, right, who had been in these industries, who were angry at their bosses, who hated working conditions, and now, you know, for both the reason of the crisis in the economy, the NLRA openings, before that even the NLRA opening, the president wants you to join a union, the work of the left, right? Now they're in these unions. Okay, this is good. This is an advance, right, that they're in these unions. But then, what do you do with these workers? How do you move them from being in a union, being class conscious, right, to engage in class struggle, to intensify, you know, to move from, you know, the step that you've taken to the next step towards socialism? The same thing exists here. All these tens of thousands of people flooding into the DSA because they're for socialism, which most of them, you know, don't know what it is, haven't really thought about it, right? But they're angry at what exists now. And that's our work, right? Is to be talking about what socialism is and how to build class consciousness and how to build class struggle and how to do these things and how to get into the weeds. I mean, that's the work that faces us in this period of on the one hand, great threat, and then on the other hand, of possibilities that we haven't seen for decades.
So I want to pick off on both Jim's comment on reforms earlier and what Christoph was just talking about, and also just the idea of nationalization. And I'm going to take it back to the 30s too. And Trotsky in 1933, in discussing with his American co-thinkers, you know, how do we approach the New Deal? Because obviously this is going to have an appeal to workers, suggested that insofar as the state wants to control the private economy, we place ourselves on the basis of government control, but from the point of view of the proletariat. We demand, first of all, the complete abolition of commercial secrets, bookkeeping and accounting of each enterprise. It should all be an open book for society and consequently, first of all, for the workers of the given enterprise. Social control over production is a fiction without the participation of the workers in this control. I'm going to skip ahead and quote and just say that, you know, he concluded by saying the bare slogan of nationalization would be insufficient, but in conjunction with the slogan of workers' control, it may acquire a revolutionary character. So I don't think just calling for nationalization is enough. And that's the fundamental problem with the Green New Deal. It's not even calling for nationalization, it's just playing games with the corporate structure as it exists right now. And I think anyone who is seriously following, you know, the environmental news, you know, realizes that this is a case, if anything is, for a rationally planned economy. Like if this is to be averted, it requires a globally, national planet, you know, and that's got to be under workers' control. It's not going to be because corporations decide that they're not going to compete with each other anymore and are going to, you know, preserve the world so that they have people to sell things to tomorrow.
Can I just add one point here? I think it's also important to think of this, like, dialectically in a sense that capital and ruling classes oftentimes vary, or even not just capital and its ruling class, but the ancient regime before them, or, you know, weird mixes like the plantation masters in the U.S. who were kind of a weird mix of capitalists like Latin nobility, have throughout their history taken really irrational, like, preemptive counter-revolutionary measures that oftentimes in turn radicalize the oppositional movement. I think the U.S. Civil War is a prime example of this occurring.
Wait, Jack, did you want to say something?
Oh, no.
Just a quick point of information. There was a huge transformative event in the 30s and early 40s, the rise of the preparatory period for the modern civil rights movement. They did not have a mechanical cotton picking machine that worked in the South until about 1930. Cotton was still the biggest export of the United States, single export of the United States in 1930. The organizing of the SP and the CP, the tenant farmers union, and the breakdown of individual sharecropping opened the road to the rise of Southern manufacturing in the 40s and 50s, which opened the road to the modern civil rights movement. So it was partly radical organizing, but partly this huge technological development. There was a racist, serious determination to keep Southern blacks in the cotton field and not to allow them to work in manufacturing except as leased convicts from the 1880s up into the 30s. And when I was a child, I don't remember riding by, and my father took me all over Georgia in the late 50s and early 60s, there was almost no sharecropping left in the cotton industry. And that prepared the groundwork for the modern civil rights movement.
Responses from the panel?
Yeah, I mean, it's a factor, right? It was a technological change, it was a factor, but it was not a factor in winning the right of black people to vote, or winning the right of black people to sit at the segregated lunch counter, or any of the other things. It was a factor in moving the African-American population to cities and to the north, and that does create certain political conditions.
Yeah.
Two questions. One is that there was kind of lurking here a question as to the significance of the historical truth, and whether the historical truth changes. Right. Jack talked about historiography, right? What became true in the 70s. And I forget your name.
Also Jack.
Jack said, well, you can have a useful fiction. You know, it can be a useful fiction that people believe something about the New Deal. And I wonder what is the significance, so to speak, of the truth, especially given that it does change, right? Historians do have, every generation have to rewrite it. The other question is more substantive, which is, I guess I want the panels to directly address the question of whether the working class can institute reforms through a capitalist party. In a sense, also to respond to Christoph, in what sense do Marxists support the reforms made by capitalist parties? Or in any sense? And relatedly, what does it mean to talk about the growth of the socialist movement? If it's not one, I think Jack spoke about the integration of the working class into the state apparatus, and implied that if there were more of that, we'd be getting closer to socialism, and whether the other panelists agree.
Can I first just correct that? I was implying that is what gets working class closer to socialism, but just that's how I would describe what social democracy is.
What was your last question? Can you repeat your last question?
Last question is whether reforms, transformations in the conditions of capitalism can be described as advances towards socialism when they are passed by capitalist working parties, right? And of course, given the fact that in a sense, socialism doesn't take responsibility for the capitalist state.
Could I just take the opportunity to make a point I wanted to make earlier to your definition of social democracy as opposed to socialism, just the idea of or the concept of the New Deal period of just integration into an apparatus. And I wanted to make the point then that there are two different things. I mean, in the case of the New Deal, and specifically the Wagner Act, there was the Wagner Act did was create an institutionalized and mediated or controlled continuing adversarial relationship between capital and labor. And that is very different from what happened in Europe, where you developed a model that did put a premium on a certain degree of participation, board representation of unions and the like. I'm not going to comment on which one gets you, which of those two models gets you closer to socialism, or for that matter, even social democracy, because that seems that, right, as far as I'm concerned, that's rather semantic.
In responding to Spencer's questions, maybe we could take a couple minutes, each of you, and conclude, because we're at time.
Yeah, I'll just say that I was reading Rich People Things, published by Haymarket at the time that Occupy Wall Street happened, and I remember that I was sort of chuckling over this idea of the New York Times, you know, doing these sociological explorations of the working class, and suddenly the book seemed instantly passé, you know, when there's actually some sort of struggle going on again. And when I think about the use being made of the New Deal, and whether it's historical useful fiction, it may seem that way to people right now because of the relatively low level of class struggle that we've experienced. But I would say that selling a false image of what it was is a kind of misleadership and a kind of misdirection, because the important thing is to know the lesson of what the New Deal really represented for the next struggle, for the next time that we are confronted with those sorts of issues. And if we obscure that from memory, thinking that this is something that can be sold to people, you know, I think that's a mistake. And I have to say, in talking about the Mandela effect, I remembered Trotsky writing in Defense of Marxism and the Revolution Betrayed, comparing the Rooseveltian New Deal programs to other corporate statist kind of programs, including Mussolini, as somebody mentioned, and experiments by fascist governments. And I remembered that part, and I remembered that Orwell's 1984 isn't just a criticism of the Stalinized Soviet Union, but also a criticism of Britain's statist tendencies at the time. And I remembered its role in the bureaucratic collectivist debate, but I had myself forgotten just how absolutely and consistently critical Trotsky and Cannon were of the New Deal. And that's, you know, being well-versed in the history of the 1934 strikes and knowing about the Trotskyist work among the unemployed and knowing about the SD and CP work among tenant farmers, I think there is a danger to the illusion of the New Deal. And, you know, it's comical on the one end to hear AOC standing up talking about the Green New Deal, and then on the other hand, there's something scary about what we've lost of the history of the left in this country.
Well, as you made a point I wanted to make earlier, that is what the slogan Green New Deal has become with that substance, and you hear a lot of mainstream Democrats saying it. I guess I would just conclude by making the point, I certainly know exactly what you're talking about, I forget exactly what you said, it's been an article that I'm trying to occupy. I mean, the point is, I wrote my book in the early 2000s on the assumption this is an antiquarian subject, the world has moved on, and it was released right on the eve of the beginning of the Sanders campaign.
Something that's got, well, just by happenstance unaddressed, Roosevelt, toward the end of his life, spoke with some detail about a continuation, an extension, as it were, a new chapter of the New Deal, things that had gone unaddressed. And of course, before any of that could be undertaken, he died, the war ended, and the Cold War closed in. So where that reformist tendency or those forces would have taken things remains an open question.
Just respond to the original question. I'll try and spirit that out if I can. I understand people's desire to tell the lessons of the New Deal in this accurate way. I'm like an aspiring historian. It's something I would like to do, and I hope people would know more about it. But there's also a means of taking advantage of something for the time being and building, using that popularization to bring people into the movement so that we can actually build the sort of institutions that are able to fight for socialism for real. So while the New Deal was not socialist, if people in the United States see it as that way and see it in a way that doesn't perfectly align with the real history, we can only actually teach them about that if we pull the people into the movement, pull them into institutions that have political education. So that's the real critical first step. So I don't think it's a sort of either or a mutually exclusive question. Like, yes, we want people to know the real history and learn real lessons from that history, but at the same time, we want to be like siloed off on the left saying, boo, no, don't get involved in this, this is wrong. We have all the right answers, we have all the right ideas. All the right ideas don't mean shit unless you have power. Unless you build institutions that can exert that power.
I think it's more either or than Jack says, because the New Deal wasn't socialist, right? And even Roosevelt said there's got to be one other chapter, right? Bernie Sanders says there's got to be an additional chapter, right? So we should not say if we could just do the New Deal then that would be fine with us, right? Because we want to go beyond the additional new chapter. We want to go over to what in our heads, and I mean, list my things in my head what is socialism, but we want to go over to real socialism. Can we institute
can we get to real socialism through reforms? You know, I think that the good part of what Jack said is that, you know, when you go to, if Republicans say Obamacare is socialist, right, and start to drill into people, well, socialism, it's created this opening, right? And we should take advantage of this opening. Is Medicare for all socialist? No. But Medicare for all would be part of it, but a socialist society would include something like Medicare for all. So we shouldn't turn our backs on, I think, fighting for things that are good and useful, but we shouldn't also delude ourselves and say, oh, Medicare for all. That's that. You know,
want to respond to what Jack said, which I think will also bring back to actually address the expenses question, which is, it occurs to me, who is alive and how many people are still alive who remember the New Deal? I mean, it seems to me, in other words, that what the New Deal was is no less completely reinvented from scratch than what socialism is or was by the Sanders campaign and by the current zeitgeist. And that needs to be borne in mind.
Okay, thank you.